The U.S. will no longer be part of the Paris Climate Change Accord. Yesterday's announcement by the president was not unexpected. The pullout was part of promises he made during the campaign. And it's why states and municipalities across the nation have been choosing to chart their own Paris path. Earlier today, I talked with UH Environmental Law Professor Maxine Burkett, and we talked about the withdrawal process and how Hawaii is positioned to act on its own.
Essentially, it means that the president and the administration are not committing to the general commitments that were made under the Paris Agreement. And the Paris Agreement was essentially agreed upon in 2015 with an incredible amount of consensus and excitement from the globe. And it's really intending to get us on a path to ratchet down our emissions to limit the global temperature increase. If he's deciding to withdraw, I sort of see it as doubling down on the horse and buggy, if you will. It's really kind of a looking backwards in terms of what we need to be doing as climate requires with respect to innovation and the opportunities that we have right now with renewable energy. And the inequitable distribution of climate change is something that impacts our country as well, and we need to be thinking more in a forward-looking fashion about that.
195 countries signed on to it. Now this leaves the U.S. coming out of it. What does that mean for the rest of the globe as countries like China and Russia are able to now make decisions regarding climate change?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we'll see new forms of leadership, new centers of leadership. In fact, the European Union and China in particular are not backing away from this agreement. In fact, they're doubling down in a very different way, which is to say they're looking to the future with all of the vulnerabilities that we face and the perils that climate change presents, and seeing it as a possibility to make themselves more resilient as countries and groups of countries, but also to allow for the globe to have a shot at having some opportunity to limit the increases in temperature that we are anticipating and we're currently experiencing. It's important to remember, though, that the statement of withdrawal that the president made yesterday is not necessarily an immediate action. In fact, it's at least 4 years if he withdraws through the provisions that are laid out in the Paris Agreement. At most, it could be 1 year if he takes the very dramatic action of removing us from the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is a 25-year-old treaty signed, drafted in part by the George H.W. Bush administration that commits us to long-term action on climate change. So that the fastest this could happen is in 1 year, and it's not clear to me which path the administration will take.
Regardless whether it's a year or 4 years, there seems to be a very, very small sliver of hope that maybe this could be renegotiated and that this may be more a face-saving move on the part of the president, who made this a central promise during the campaign. Do you have any hope that that would be so, given what you're seeing around the country?
Well, with respect to what we do as a nation state, I think it's probably unlikely that we will renegotiate. In fact, that was an option on the table. On the table for the president was to go full bore on the commitments made in the Paris Agreement, to withdraw, and then the middle ground was to renegotiate. But in order to renegotiate, you need to stay at the table. And withdrawing is essentially saying that you're removing yourself from the conversation. So if there really was an attempt to, in good faith, be a part of this agreement, that would have been an option. I don't see that at this point.
With industry, some companies very upset over all of this, and a movement across the country in various cities and various states. I'm thinking about Salt Lake City, Atlanta, LA, just to name a few, where there are very clear movements to stay on the Paris path regardless. Do you think this is now becoming the groundswell movement that may, in fact, eclipse what happens federally?
I think so. I think what we're seeing is a taking of responsibility by the private sector. The private sector, certainly, many of the big leaders, eBay, Apple, Tesla, they have seen this as a massive risk. Even the more traditional entities, fossil fuel companies, ExxonMobil as one, understands the risk and is finally taking action after quite a lot of time of not. And so what we're seeing is that they recognize the risk to their investment, to their supply chain, train. They recognize the opportunity again in renewable energy sources and are really seizing that and are looking to be, I think, leaders to fill the vacuum. We also, like you're saying, have subnational actors or state and local actors that are really significant. And there are a number of ways in which cities and states have formed alliances and coalitions to not only meet the standards of the Paris Agreement, but to move beyond those standards. Because what we know about the Paris Agreement, as much as it was a welcome agreement amongst countries, it does not meet the scientific requirement, which is if we were to stick with the Paris Agreement and its requirements in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, you're still looking at upwards of 3 degrees Celsius of increase in global temperature, which with it has catastrophic consequences. So, yes, there we are seeing the Under 2 coalition that's looking at getting emissions below 2 degrees Celsius. The United States Climate Alliance was just announced today by the states of California, New York, and Washington as examples.
In Hawaii, too, we have a piece of legislation that was brought forth by Kalani English. It's waiting on Governor Ige's desk for signature. This was done in preparation for a potential pullout because, again, we've been talking about this as a possibility since the days of the campaign. How do you think this sets up Hawaii to be able to enter with other states and other cities in the Paris path?
Well, I think we now, once the governor signs this piece of legislation, we have an act and a state law that requires that we essentially meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. It's important to remember that, again, the Paris Agreement itself, as it stands, is not as ambitious as we need to be. And I think this is important for Hawaii to remember because I like to describe us as sort of ahead of the curve but behind the ball. In other words, we are ahead of the curve in terms of being amongst the states and cities that are and countries that are thinking in a very ambitious way about being more resilient and reducing our risk. But at the same time, we are unusually vulnerable as an isolated island state. And so we have all of the climate impacts that the continental U.S. will experience, plus the uniqueness of being in the middle of the ocean. And so we have to be mindful of our individual risk. But yes, this particular act, if it's signed, will follow along a sort of a longish line, 10 years of pretty good climate-related legislation, whether you're talking about the Global Warming Solutions Act or the barrel fee. The establishment of the Climate Change Adaptation Planning Priority Guidelines. We have seen a really great trajectory of state based law that is attempting to not only make us more resilient in the face of the impacts, but also to reduce our emissions, which is also has the twin effect of making us more risk-free to the extent that we allow for our coastlines to be more secure and our water savings to be more mindful of climate impacts and all of those measures.
Federal funds that could play into that could be threatened. How does that leave us as an island state where, you know, very clearly we have leaders, including Senator Schatz, and yesterday we also heard from Mayor Caldwell, leaving us vulnerable in ways that other states clearly are not?
Well, federal funding has been a very significant part of what we have as, you know, sort of world-class research here in Hawaii that also supplements work that's happening in the continental U.S. And so it's a very major loss to have that on the horizon. We're not expecting for there to be additional federal funding in this regard. But I will say that we're starting to see philanthropic organizations filling some of the gap. So as an example, Bloomberg's philanthropic arm has just committed to essentially paying our fees for as the United States as part of the Framework Convention Secretariat. In other words, allowing for us to support the efforts that are happening internationally, even if our federal government doesn't do that. I assume that there will be much more gap filling that way. It's not nearly as large of a pot of funds, but it is an opportunity, I think, for interesting and dynamic and innovative partnerships to build over time so that we have a diversity of sources that assist us in figuring out this riddle of how to not just reduce emissions but remain resilient as climate change continues to present itself and get worse over that period.
Do you see any of that cost shifting happening locally?
It's too early to tell, I think. And, of course, again, the sums are quite distinct. But I think the interest is becoming much more diverse. And we're seeing a real leaning in of various sectors. And certainly at the city level, we obviously have been able to leverage the funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, 100 Resilient Cities. And we have a chief resilience officer. We have an office of climate change, sustainability, and resiliency. These are things that were sort of fortuitous or serendipity that they happened at this time when they're so sorely needed.
But funding, for example, for the latter office for the city, that's not necessarily all there.
That's not all there, and we need to keep pushing so that they can have a sensible rollout for the office, which itself, again, will have many co-benefits. Again, resiliency building is a cost-saving measure in and of itself, but also to the extent that we can become more efficient in our city operations, that we'll see cost savings there too.
In general, how hopeful are you that regardless of what happens federally, that we will be able to continue on the path?
I think we have to be very realistic about what we're facing. So I want to share a deep sense of optimism and certainly an energy and recommitment to doing this work, especially because we have, again, this diverse grouping of folks that are undaunted. So on one hand, the task is quite sizable and significant, but there are many glimmers of hope. And again, if we look at just the city of New York, the state of New York, the state of California, the state of Washington, these states represent one-fifth of the country's population and GDP, only 10 to 11% of their emissions. These are states that are really taking hold of the leadership in this area, and they have a sizable sort of amount of people and funds to do that. And so I think if we find our allies across this country and the globe, I think we will be in very good shape.
Maxine Burkett, thank you.
Thank you.
Maxine Burkett is a law professor at the University of Hawaii Richardson School of Law. She focuses on climate justice and exploring the disparate impact of climate change on vulnerable communities in the United States and around the world. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Later in the show, it's a great place to live, unless you're talking money. First, here's your backyard quiz. Next, we'll be hearing about wildfire prevention efforts in Hawaii. Chances are you've probably had to participate in a fire drill once or twice. For today's quiz, we're thinking about a different type of fire, a structure fire, that took place in one of Hawaii's intermediate schools. The inferno completely destroyed the school's 23-year-old central building and charred some of the surrounding property. The damage totaled a then-whopping $500,000. When the flames broke out, there were 35 students in the building attending a Japanese class, and all made it to safety. How much their fire drills were responsible for their response and safe evacuation may be debatable. At the very least, it's a reminder that it never hurts to be prepared for the worst. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the name of the Hawaii school reduced to rubble by a fire in December of 1949. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you'll get the prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
This week, police arrested the suspected arsonist in the rash of Hawaiʻi fires. The area has been the scene of more than a dozen fires since the beginning of the year. With the hot, dry summer months ahead, the Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization is reminding the state that wildfires are nearly always started by people, regardless of intent. Elizabeth Pickett is the organization's executive director, and she's on the phone now. Hello.
Hi, Bethan.
Good to talk to you. Now, everybody was really concerned about what was going on in Hawaiʻi, and a lot of attention flowed in that direction. But as you look out over the year, can you put that into context about what we expect to see in a given year and fires?
Yeah, you know, Hawaii has only recently characterized its wildfire situation over the entire state, thanks to fire history mapping and statewide wildfire hazard assessments. And we know that over 98% of wildfires are human-caused. We know that the proportion of Hawaii that burns each year is often equal to or more than any other U.S. state. And while those acre numbers may be lower than other states because Hawaii is small, wildfires have long-lasting and broad impacts. And so preparedness and hazard reduction are really critical all year long, and particularly as we get into the dry season.
Can you also talk a little bit about the fires that you see that are started because of an arsonist and those that are started by people because of an accident? Do we have some real data on that?
You know, we don't have great data or many prosecutions that have to do with arson, but we do know that since fires are started by humans, it will be either accidentally or intentionally. And because almost 25% of our state is covered with non-native fire-prone grasses, it's really easy to have accidental ignitions as well as arson. And we do know also that fires are being started on both windward and leeward sides of every island in the state, and fires can only carry where there is fuel. So we really need to be looking at reducing the fire hazard and reducing that flammable vegetation wherever possible.
You talk about where fires can be started, and sometimes people don't necessarily look in that direction. Are you trying to myth bust a little bit about what we may believe concerning where fires start and really who we should be looking at ourselves?
Maybe a little bit. I mean, definitely arson is a problem, and it's a very scary problem for many people. But I think what we're mostly trying to do is put the power back in the hands of people who may be having concerns or fears related to fire. Fire can only burn where there is fuel. So there's a lot that people can do to protect their homes and families from fire. And also there's a lot we can do to reduce accidental ignitions by being careful with campfires, fireworks, equipment that may spark, and even when idling cars on the side of the road where there may be dry grasses. I think people don't realize how many accidental fire ignitions there are.
We just got the outlook for the summer, June through September. And according to the National Significant Wildland Fire Potential Outlook, the Big Island is again shaded in red for the entire summer, saying that there's going to be above normal large fire potential. What does that mean for the Big Island?
I think what that means for the Big Island and also for our organization is that we really need to engage communities and remind people that preparedness and hazard reduction are critical to reducing the likelihood of fire and also fire impacts. You know, firefighters are really the last line of defense. It needs to start with prevention and preparedness. And like I said, there's a lot that people can do to prevent fires that are ignited from carrying across homes and landscapes.
Specifically, what would you ask everybody to do tomorrow over the weekend?
Anything that you have been meaning to do around your landscape or your yard is probably good for fire prevention and vegetation management. You know, cleaning leaves, dry leaves, and out of your rain gutters, cleaning up debris piles, getting rid of dead and drying vegetation, all of the things that might go under the category of good housekeeping are also great for fire preparedness and protection.
If your home or condo units or development is up against land that's maintained by city and county, and you notice that there's a lot of brush up there, I mean, thinking about looking up into the hills and seeing some of that, what would you have people do when they really can't get up there and police it themselves?
Well, most of the fire departments will field phone calls and complaints about brush abatement needs, but really there's still a lot you can do right in the home ignition zone, very close to your own home, right up against it, against your windows, very nearby. You can actually deal with the vegetation there and replace anything you can with non-combustible building materials. And most importantly, it's just having that situational awareness. I mean, we can't control all of the vegetation all around us, but we certainly can work together with our neighbors and our communities to try to take that zoom out perspective and make sure that we are being managed in a very fire protective way. But also knowing if it is fire season and there is a likelihood of fire, having a family preparedness and evacuation plan in place and practice is also a key to being prepared for that.
A lot of families say, well, we intended to do this. We really thought we would get it done by now. But have we really gotten a wake-up call with some of the fires that we've seen so early in the season this year that you really need to sit down and do it?
I hope so. I don't know if that's bad to say, but I know that fires often go under-publicized. The impacts can be very scary and sometimes devastating, particularly to our natural resources and the edges of our communities. And I'd like it to be a wake-up call. I think it's not on the minds or on the radar of many people year-round, like it is maybe for those who work with our organization or our partners. But certainly, Hawaii has a devastating fire issue. We have a high fire hazard. And it really is time for people to just make the time to prioritize it. It really is insurance against impacts on our landscape and also to your home and family.
Elizabeth, before we let you go, you mentioned that fires are under-publicized. Very quickly, why?
Well, in part, it has to do with the fires are occurring across all of the islands and that our agencies have kept separate records, but we now have compiled all those records, and we really can see the size and scale and scope of the fire issues across Hawaii, and it's severe, and our hazard is high. So it's just now that we're being able to get the word out to really underline the fact that we need to get better prepared and to reduce our hazards in a way that we haven't in the past.
And are you going to be able to combine all of that data and make it available so people can actually get a handle on what's happening with fire in Hawaii?
Absolutely. In fact, our website, hawaiiwildfire.org, has a ton of information for teachers, legislators, and the public in terms of the history and background on fire in Hawaii, as well as actions people can take around their home and with their community to prevent the impacts and reduce the likelihood of fire in your area.
Thanks very much for the time today. All good information.
No, thank you.
Elizabeth Pickett is the executive director of the Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization. It's a nonprofit that leads and implements wildfire-focused planning, hazard education, and reduction, and projects across Hawaii and the Pacific. And this being a Friday, one of the things we do is take a look at what our news department is working on for the coming week. And to help us with that preview, HPR's news director Bill Dorman has just popped into the studio. Hello there.
Aloha, Bethann. Good to see you. Never know what a Friday is going to bring.
Well, this is true. That's part of the fun of it. But we do know that the Hokulea will be back very soon and looking to do a last check-in with them.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to believe that the worldwide voyage, the Hokulea left Hawaii back in 2013, and it's approaching, it's at least returning to the island, still a couple of weeks away, scheduled to come into Honolulu Saturday morning, the 17th of June, Magic Island, the point of arrival on that. But first, we'll get an update from the crew along the way as they are in the home stretch, truly. You know, Molly Solomon started out doing these updates a couple of years back, and every other week now, Casey Harlow has picked them up. And we got one more check-in coming next week from the ocean, so that'll be good to hear from them.
So that takes care of the ocean. What about the land?
Yeah, so Kuʻuvehi Hidishi has been looking into this whole story of hiking trails that are on the lands of the Board of Water Supply. And here on Oahu, one trail that gets an awful lot of attention when we're talking about this, the so-called Stairway to Heaven, the haiku stairs on the windward side. Just this morning, as an example, a couple of hikers rescued there, airlifted out. But there are not surprisingly a lot of parts to this. It's not just a matter of liability and insurance. There's an area of stewardship of the land, care of the land, maintenance of all of that. Neighborhood board meeting coming up in Kaneohe. Part of this story, certainly a lot more to come. And Kuʻuvehi is going to sketch that out a bit later next week.
And we've got a story from the Big Island involving a very famous photo.
You know, hard to believe, again, looking back 28 years ago, this Saturday was the night when authorities in Beijing cleared Tiananmen Square after the demonstrations. And the people who were there talk about the terror and the violence and the absolute chaos. And in the days afterwards, there was the chaos. And a famous picture of a man standing in front of a tank, AP photographer. Story of that photo coming next week, and we'll also tell you why he's in Hawaii.
Looking forward to that one in particular. Thanks so much, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. We're finding out where Hawaii folks stand on President Trump's performance to date and Hawaii's action against his travel ban. Civil Beat editor Patty Epler joins us now with her brand new poll. Hi there.
Hello, Beth Ann. How are you?
Doing all right, but it doesn't appear to be that perhaps the president is, according to some of your numbers. Not that that may be a surprise to a lot of people.
That's true. This is such a blue state here, Hawaii, that it's not a surprise that he has a low approval rating here, as our recent poll has just shown, of 32%.
Not necessarily something that would be a great number, but how does that fare regarding the people who have actually voted for President Trump in our state?
So he collected 29% of the vote in the last election in November. So he's actually just a little bit higher than that now, 32 versus 29. But you have to remember that in the election there were four candidates on the ballot, I think. So
this poll was done through the 24th of May.
Correct. It was May 18th through the 24th, and we polled roughly 1,000 people statewide, about 950 of them here on Oahu, and it has a margin of error of about 3.2%, I believe.
The point being that this was done before we heard the announcement yesterday. Of anything that might suggest from what you polled and how you were asking the questions, how that might play out? Because clearly we've been talking about that for the last week or so.
I think that would probably drop him even lower here in Hawaii, just based on the news reports of how people reacted to the, you're referring to the pullout of the Paris Climate Agreement. So we did ask voters about several things that already had occurred while, at the time of our poll. One was the travel ban, and of course, 53% of the folks here in Hawaii that we polled were very opposed to the travel ban and supported Hawaii's efforts to have it overturned. And we also asked about the sanctuary city issue, and 45% of the folks here disagree with Trump on the sanctuary city issue. And we also asked about just generally to test the waters for what people, think, even though no one can know this for sure. But really, a majority, 51%, actually think either the president himself or his campaign staff colluded with Russia to sort of sway the election in his direction. It's kind of interesting.
We'll see what happens the next time you do this poll and whether those numbers move and which direction they move. Thanks, Patty, for giving us at least a snapshot of what is on your website today.
No problem. Happy Aloha Friday.
And you too. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring editor Patty Epler.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Okay, we know, you know, living in Hawaii means living with higher costs. That's only one measure of making a living in Hawaii. Once again, the personal finance website MoneyRates.com has ranked states from best to worst using criteria beyond just cost of living. Other benchmarks include workplace safety, state tax burdens, median wages, and unemployment rates. We won't keep you in suspense any longer. For a seventh year in a row, Hawaii came in dead last. We called MoneyRates.com's spokesperson Richard Barrington, and we talked about the reasons why Hawaii has done so poorly again.
Well, the real handicap that Hawaii has to overcome is its extraordinarily high cost of living. The good news is that wages in Hawaii are relatively high. The median income is $40,000 or $40,030, and this is nearly 10% higher than the typical state's median income. That's the good news. The bad news is that the cost of living in Hawaii is more than 60% higher than the national average, and that's a natural side effect of an island economy. So many things have to be imported over a great distance, and the labor pool is more constrained than in other parts of the country where employers can draw freely from neighboring states. But anyway, when you compare wages with the cost of living, you have an average wage that's 10% above the norm, but that doesn't come close to compensating for costs that are more than 60% above normal. Compounding the problem is that for a median wage earner, Hawaii's state income tax burden is the third highest in the nation. This takes another 6.4% off the purchasing power of a Hawaiian wage earner. So when you combine the effects of the high cost of living and the heavy tax burden, for every dollar a median wage earner makes in Hawaii, he or she only gets 56 cents worth of purchasing power. So that's the obstacle that Hawaii has long struggled to overcome.
For those of us who live and work here, this is the reality of our lives. After having done this now for 7 years, charting every state, do you have any idea how this might be better the next time you look at it, given the fact that, you know, past is prologue and we really haven't seen a whole lot of movement in the last 7 years?
Yes. If there is a light at the end of the tunnel, it's the possibility that workers in Hawaii may see stronger wage gains going forward, and that would better compensate for that high cost of living. And the reason why I say that they might see better wage gains is that back in 2011, when we first did this study, the unemployment rate in Hawaii was 6.4%, which, believe it or not, at the time was good enough for seventh lowest in the nation. Now, today, that unemployment rate is just 2.7%, and that's the second lowest in the nation. So Hawaii's unemployment rate has gone down in absolute terms from 6.4 to 2.7%, and also it's improved relative to other states, from seventh best to second best. Now, if you've ever done any hiring, you know that 2.7% of the labor pool are pretty much unemployable. In other words, once the unemployment rate gets down that low, employers have dipped about as deeply into the labor pool as they can possibly go, and they're going to have to start offering higher wages to recruit capable workers. In time, this should better compensate for the island's high cost of living.
When you talk about only the U3 number, which is the one that you just gave, the 2.7%, we also look at the U6 number, which is more like 7.1%, those people who are underemployed or who have simply dropped out. because they haven't been able to find something that, that meets their needs. We're also told that employers are poaching, and that's how they're able to fill some of their higher needs, and also that they can't fill some of the jobs that go wanting now. And yet we haven't seen a wage increase that would be meaningful enough to attract workers. That seems to be in a little bit in opposition to what you're saying now, at least for the short term.
So the two of the trends that you talked about, the poaching and the fact that there are vacancies going unfilled, both of those would argue for the fact that employers are getting and will have to get more aggressive about salaries and benefits that they offer workers in order to attract people to fill the slots that, that need to be filled. So this would argue for higher wage gains going forward than 7 years ago when there was certainly a lot more slack in the employment market.
When we've talked to the Chamber of Commerce about many of their members, what the Chamber has come back with is, you know, our members are offering as competitive salaries as they can, and this is the best that they're able to do. And yet very clearly, that's not helping a lot of workers who are dealing with just the circumstances that you talked about a little earlier. What do you think is going to have to happen to push that needle further if pretty much of many of the employers are happy with the status quo, even though they know that they are going to have to rob Peter to pay Paul to get people into their firms?
Well, that's the thing, is that it's always going to be a cost-benefit decision for a business owner. And for a long time, there has been a lot of slack in the employment market, and so employers in many cases have gotten away with offering substandard wage increases, low wage increases. However, as they see vacancies start to cost them business because their businesses are no longer able to run to full capacity, they're going to have to make decisions. A decision that basically comes down to this: do I give up a little bit more of my profit margin to my employees, or do I forego those profits altogether because I don't have enough staff to do that piece of business? And so a rational business person under these conditions would offer the employees a little more. And so I think the point of me contrasting now with 2011 is to say that dynamic has definitely shifted more in a direction that should help workers going forward. It's understandable why it's been wage gains have been meager over the past few years, but that dynamic has changed, and I think you should see better wage gains going forward.
A lot of workers are going to hope you're right, Richard. Thanks very much for the time.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Richard Barrington is a chartered financial analyst and the primary spokesperson for the personal finance website, MoneyRates.com. Earlier in the program, we remembered a disastrous fire that took place in 1949. Fortunately, there was no loss of life in this fire, which burned one of Honolulu's intermediate schools to the ground. During the blaze, the school's 23-year-old main building was destroyed, and the flames turned the surrounding area into a charred mess. Ultimately, the damage totaled an estimated $500,000. Those were in 1949 dollars. That's more like $5 million in terms of today's dollars. Despite all the damage, all 35 of the students attending class in the building managed to evacuate safely. For our quiz, we asked you to tell us the name of the school, and nobody knew that the answer is Washington Intermediate School. Well, that's today's quiz, but if you've got one for us, you can always send it in to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
Most artists might dream of doing what Yvonne Chang does. The Indonesian-born Hawaii artist has, for years, made a living from her work. Her paintings are often in the public eye. Her large-scale canvases feature Polynesian women, often languid and dreamy. Tonight, eyes will be on her work in a solo show. It's part of the first Friday offerings at the Hawaii State Art Museum. And Yvonne Chang is in our studio with us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. You have long been fascinated with Hawaiian women and Hawaiian women's faces. How did that start?
When I first moved to Hawaii, which is in the 60s, I ended up at somewhere in the country where they had a luau, and these big Hawaiian women came on and danced the hula, and it was in a natural environment. And I got totally fascinated that despite their size, how incredibly graceful they were. And looking at their faces, there was this peacefulness in their face and their hands and their feet. And I just became fascinated with it.
You paint them a lot. I won't say almost exclusively, but they show up in your work so much and in a very large scale. Is that because you looked at them relative to the size of them physically and replicated that, or because you were trying to make a different kind of statement by making a very large canvas?
Well, I like working large canvases because, let's face it, you know, it's easier to fit a large figure in the canvases. But what I am trying to do is to show that the Western idea of beauty is so different than the Polynesian idea of beauty. It's not so much physical, but what they, how they move and their dance and their facial expressions. There's a gentleness in them.
There seems to be also more than just gentleness when you look at some of the faces and some of the emotions that you can almost feel as you walk by some of these canvases. What do you feel when you look at these faces?
There's a strength, a quiet strength in them. And it's hard for me to really put it into words. I just paint what I see and what I feel. And I usually leave it up to the other person, what they see in it.
Yeah. When you walk by a lot of your canvases, one of the things that one would notice is your use of color. Not bright color, but more earthy color.
Yeah, I like earthy colors. And it's because of my batik. When I first came here, I took batik classes at the Bishop Museum. And they're natural dyes, Inco dyes. And my batik teacher just gave us the main colors, and you had to kind of make your own mixtures. Fortunately, when I was growing up in Indonesia, I learned how to do that. So this is why I learned how to do the mix different colors to get different nuances. And since I like the earthy colors, so I stuck with it.
And the shading that you do with color and how you're able to create that earthiness and yet at the same time a very compelling palette. You mix all of your own colors?
Yes, most of the time. You know, I don't use straight colors. There is a richness, a certain richness, I think, if you mix your colors. Because they're not quite the color, but yet they are the color. You know, but there is a certain depth in them.
You mentioned your growing up in Indonesia, where there's a lot of batik, and watching women painstakingly trying to make these beautiful patterns. It's amazingly meticulous work. Some of those patterns find evidence in your work, but not necessarily in the same sort of painstaking way in which you do, because it's just, it's labor intensive. Yeah. But in general, your fascination with textiles and patterns comes from seemingly very different places in the world.
Well, my paintings, they all are the classic Hawaiian tapa patterns. But I've always been fascinated in patterns, colors, and how to use them. And I'm always looking around, and it just is naturally. It comes natural.
When you talk about coming naturally, some say, too, that that is exactly what would describe what happens when you get around children. And having seen you in the Art in the Schools program once a long time ago, and knowing that you would love to have kids around you and just give them canvases to paint, how do you think we approach kids now with art, and how would you like us to if we're not doing it in that way?
You know, I think now it's so different for younger kids to grow up, because there's TV, there's, you know, it's an entirely different way of growing up. In I think the old time, the beauty of it is we learned how to imagine. You know, there were very basic things, but then we learned to look at things in a different way and use our imagination. And it still happens, but a lot of it is, it's immediate. You know, the kids look at TV, and it's immediate. It's like watching cartoons. It's more what other people show them instead of, like in the old days, there were a lot of crafts. You know, you create your own environment. And sometimes I think that nowadays children lose a lot in creating things from simple, you know, from simple starts.
Including having colors they have to mix.
Yes.
And a canvas, or at least just a piece of paper. Yvonne Chang, thank you so much for coming in. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yvonne Chang is a Hawaii-based artist whose work focuses on Polynesian women. She'll be one of the artists featured tonight during First Friday at the Hawaii State Art Museum.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
We just talked a little bit about First Friday tonight over at the High Sam, but there are so many activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us now for a look at some of the events going on in the community that might be a little under the radar.
A little, yes.
And we're going to start talking about the fact that it's the season for a traditional Japanese celebration.
That's right, Beth Ann. Tomorrow, Hawaii's Plantation Village in Waipahu hosts an evening of obon, dancing, fun, food, crafts, and of course, dancing. Various dance clubs from the area will be there. Foods from Hawaii's various ethnic groups will be available for purchase. There will be unique gift items featuring one-of-a-kind hapi coats made by village crafters. So bring your own chairs or mats for this. It's 4:30 to 10 p.m. in Hawaii's Plantation Village in Waipahu. That's tomorrow, and it's free.
And for something entirely different, there's a free family caregiver workshop on Kauai tomorrow.
Yes, you can't predict when you or a member of your family will have an accident or illness that could result in a hospital stay. But you can improve the chances of getting good care both in and out of the hospital by doing the right kind of planning. Learn what to do from an expert. AARP sponsors this free workshop with Dr. Laurel Coleman. Pastries and coffee will be provided. It's from 9:30 a.m. until noon in the Marriott Courtyard Kauai at Coconut Beach. So go to our website for more information about this.
And on Maui, you can see a robotics demonstration tomorrow.
That's right. Join Maui Preparatory Academy and Lokelani Intermediate School's robotics teams to see an amazing demonstration of robotics, axles, motors, gears, chassis. Mm-hmm. If you're into this, you can see how they work together to make a movable robot. And you can even try your hand at test driving a robot as well. It's in the Kihei Public Library from 10 a.m. until noon, and this is free.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
Yes.
Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at some of the events in the community that might be going a little under the radar. You can always find a whole lot more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's going to do it for us as we head off into the weekend. Coming next week, we're going to take a look at what's in store for the 2017 Pacific hurricane season and a whole lot more. We like to hear from you, and you can always call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number. It's 808-792-8217. Or if you like, you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also post comments on Facebook. Find us at The Conversation. If you like Twitter, we're there too. You can tweet us at HI Conversation, or if you want to tweet me, I'm at BKOZHPR. If you missed any part of this show or you want to hear another one again, you can always find them on the new HPR app. You can search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. Our executive producer, well, is me. Lillian Song produces the program, and Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Have a great weekend.